Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and coming to you live from Marietta, Georgia today. I'm actually in the break room at my office where I work, so it's a little bit different setting for me today, but hopefully all will go smoothly, and we have a fantastic, really, really interesting guest for you today. Our guest is David Benjamin, and David is the executive director of the ITA. And just to give you a little bit of background on him, David played tennis and squash at Harvard University and then became the head coach of varsity tennis and squash at Princeton in 1974. So he's got an extensive background in college varsity sports. He was the captain and the number one singles player on the 1963 undefeated freshman Harvard team. And that summer, he won the USTA National Junior 18 Consolation Singles Championships at Kalamazoo and also played in the U.S. National Championships at Forest Hills. So he has also a very accomplished junior career under his belt. David is also an author. He's written two books. One is titled Competitive Tennis, and the other is the ITA Guide to Coaching Winning Tennis. He has been involved with the ITA, which is the governing body of tennis, since 1979, and that was the year he was first elected president of ITA. In 1981, he was re-elected as president and appointed as the executive director, and that's a position he's held ever since then. He is part of the decision-making body that governs 1,500 member coaches, 15,000 collegiate tennis players, and more than 1,000 men's and women's college tennis programs at the NCAA Division I, Division II, Division III, NAIA, and junior/community college levels. So David is intimately involved in college tennis and has been throughout his tennis career, and we are very, very lucky to have him on the show today. So David, welcome to Parenting Aces, and thank you so, so much for being here to talk with us.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, we have a lot to discuss today, so I'm going to just jump right in with you, if you don't mind. There's been a lot going on in the college tennis world, and one of the things that has been very disturbing as of late is the cutting of college tennis programs. And I know that you have been very active in soliciting support for the programs that are on the chopping block. You send out letters to coaches and others in the tennis world, you know, asking for them to write letters of support for these programs. And I'm just curious what you see happening in that arena in terms of programs being cut or how many programs are being saved by this letter writing campaign.
It's a very good and very, very important question. We first became worried about the phenomenon of programs being dropped in the mid-1980s, early 1990s. And we talked a lot among ourselves, we meaning the ITA college coaches, and by the 90s we also reached out to the USTA. The USTA, of course, is the governing body of American tennis, and were not very involved on the college scene. And in reaching out to the USTA, we felt that the resources that that the USTA had could be very helpful in trying to stem this tide. And there were basically two reasons, because we did a lot of research initially to see why were programs being dropped. And this is men's and women's programs across the board, all of the different divisions that you mentioned in your introduction, junior colleges and community colleges. And to generalize, there are two primary reasons why programs were dropped. And one was budgets, and that is a significant concern. And over the years, budgets have gotten on many campuses tighter and tighter, and more pressure on athletic directors and financial planners for the university to find ways to save money. And one of the ways was and is cutting programs, including in some cases tennis. And then the other factor that was very clearly an element, mainly at the Division I level, was the growing importance of Title IX. And for those listeners who aren't that familiar with Title IX, it's legislation that was interpreted by the Department of Education that mandated that all colleges, and this affected even private schools that were not state schools, because any college or university that was receiving any monies from the government could be impacted if they were not complying with Title IX. And on a legal level, there could be consequences too. So there became more and more pressure on each school to look at the athletic department and the resources that were being spent on men's and women's programs, both financially but also the opportunities for men and women to play college sports. And the big dilemma that actually, when you look back historically, almost wasn't a dilemma, was the fact that obviously many, many, many colleges and universities have men's football programs, and they have a large number of players, and the salary of the staff is usually fairly large, and the scholarships, if they're scholarship schools, add up to a lot. So one of the original amendments for Title IX would have said that there had to be an equivalence on the men and women's side, excluding the sport of football. So if for example, a school spent $1 million on football, they wouldn't have to, that would not be included in the overall monies that had to be spent equally. But what ended up as an interpretation was football was included. And so this put a lot of pressure on many schools, because there was not a women's football program. So if, again, a school was spending millions of dollars on football and had 115 people on the squad, it had to spend, when you add up all the different programs, an even amount of money on the women's side and have even numbers. And one of the ways that many athletic departments addressed that was by cutting some of the men's programs, so that number-wise, the numbers would be somewhat equivalent, and also financially. And many sports were affected by this. Maybe the most dramatically were men's gymnastics and men's wrestling over a 10 or 15 year period were almost decimated. And tennis was badly hit on the Division I level. And, of course, NCAA Division I permits scholarships for most of the team. The legislation allows 8 full scholarships for women's Division I tennis if a school has the capability of giving 8, and 4.5 for men. So as Title IX became the law of the land, and as more and more schools began to focus on this, as there were some cases where schools were found, I think particularly a case involving Brown University, in violation of Title IX, and there were ramifications, one could see at the Division I level more and more in tennis, men's programs being dropped for the reason I explained. And on the Division I level, I would guesstimate that roughly 80% of the programs dropped have been men's programs, not women's programs, when as soon as you get to Division II, III, NIA, junior community colleges, it's pretty even men and women. So to try to, you know, summarize, it even with the Title IX element does have a financial budgetary factor to it, but at the Division I level, the vast majority of the schools that have lost tennis programs have been in order to try for the athletic department decisions being made to try to comply mm-hmm. with Title IX. And for most of the other programs dropped to non-Division I, it's usually for budgetary reasons. And when we if you go on the ITA website, we have a chart from the beginning of college tennis through this year of the number of programs dropped, and the largest number were dropped in the 90s, and then the first 10 years of this century. It slowed down a lot, but when you look back over the last 30 years, there have been a tremendous number of programs dropped, men's and women's, roughly over 300 plus programs. As we became more concerned and studied the problem, the question is what can you do about it? And we felt there were a number of things that we could do and that the coaches should do. Maybe the most important is to encourage the coaches to build a strong program within the community, not only have a program that had excellent players and had a great record in terms of winning titles, but a program that involved the local community, both the campus community and the town, and that the more friends that the program had and the more people that would support the program in coming to matches and being involved and the more engaged, then that was a support system that mattered a great deal when an athletic director had to decide what programs they were going to drop. So we put together...
Let me interrupt you. I just want to say A lot of the college coaches are doing a really, really good job at that now. Mm-hmm. And This year, more than I've seen in the years I've been following tennis or college tennis, this year I have seen a huge effort on the part of the coaches and their staff to really use social media to publicize their matches, publicize giveaways and promotions that they're doing in conjunction with the matches, publicize clinics that they're holding for area junior players and at-risk kids and all of that. So, I think that's fantastic. But back to my original question, is the letter writing campaign making a difference? I mean, is it stopping these programs from being cut, or, you know, what are you seeing out there?
Well, one, the number of programs dropped has slowed a significant amount over the last 8-10 years. We started we call it the ITA Advocacy Network in cooperation with the USTA. There are roughly 2,500 people who care about college tennis throughout the country. And as you explained, Lisa, when we hear that there might be a problem with the program being dropped, we reach out to that network along with many other groups to try to, whether it's in terms of writing letters, if it's a school where one of the advocates knows someone on the board of trustees, so much the better, or the athletic director. But there has, one, been a definite slowdown in the rate of schools being dropped. We've also managed to bring back about 50 programs that had been dropped, and some of those are new programs that are being created. So I think there's some good news about that, but part of the letter writing campaign is to make it, when you think about it, well, if an athletic director has to drop three programs and has to choose among five or six, some of it's going to be subjective. Maybe if that athletic director likes a particular sport, that will be a factor. It could well be, again, if someone on the board of trustees is a supporter of that sport, that can make a difference. But one of the things that the school and the athletic director are going to think about is this going to cause problems for them to drop the program? Is there going to be ramifications? And one of the reasons for the letter writing, and we write letters to the president, to the board of trustees, and when I say we, the ITA, I write a personal letter, the president of the USTA writes a personal letter, we have a number of key people besides the advocates writing letters. So some of it is to make it clear that this is, and explain in detail why this is harmful not just to college tennis, but to the school, and why there should be a reconsideration. It depends on the situation as to whether it stops the program from being dropped. I've been in a number of situations with coaches and schools where the school already has made the decision before we ever hear about it. Sometimes the coach is the last person to know intentionally. And one example would be a situation with Rutgers, where the decision had been made behind the scenes. This is 8 or 10 years ago, to drop men's tennis, men and women's fencing, men and women's crew. There was correspondence that came to the front later between the president of the school at the time, who's no longer there, and the athletic director, saying there's going to be some, you know, complaints, but we just have to stay tough, and we're going to do this, because they wanted to spend more money in building a football stadium. And so the letters, and we went to board of trustee meetings, we went even to state legislature meetings. It was a done deal, and we couldn't change it. In some cases, we've managed to get a reprieve, and the president or the athletic director agrees to wait a year and to review. In some cases, we've managed to prevent the program from being dropped. But it's a tough situation, and I think we feel, one, it's important to do this, even if only in a small percentage of times does it stop the program or save the program. In some cases, in writing the letters and creating more awareness, the program, the athletic director and the president say, you know, we have to do this now, but we're willing to reconsider in a year or two from now. In some cases, they have. So, but it's not going to go away as a problem, because, as you know, as everyone knows, reading the newspaper and listening to programs on TV and radio, the schools are struggling more and more financially. There are more and more questions being asked about money being spent on college sports. As we know, the NCAA is under tremendous scrutiny and pressure about all of this. So, I don't think that the dynamics are going to change. I think we've made progress. I think that the efforts that the coaches are making, more and more coaches are making those efforts, and that's great. Even if programs weren't being dropped, it really is the best thing possible for the men and women's coaches to get involved with the community, to bring NJTL is a great program nationwide. I think there's 650 chapters, and there are many other programs in inner city situations, and to bring younger people on campuses, to make them more aware of education, even if they don't end up playing on a varsity team, there's also a great program, the USTA, and we started together about 14 years ago called Tennis on Campus. That's a lot of fun, and I believe there are something like 40,000 young people on campuses playing tennis on campus now. So I think to involve the community more is great. And certainly it will help the coaches keep their programs at the same time.
But tennis on campus is not a way to utilize tennis as a way to pay for college. Varsity tennis.
No, absolutely not. No. No, the thinking
for that's an important distinction for parents to understand. Tennis on campus is a recreational campus-based club program, and it's great, but it's not a way for a child to utilize their tennis to go to college. And
absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
So I get a little on edge when that's offered up as, you know, kind of the alternative, because it's not.
I can tell you, Lisa, that in front of the president and the athletic director at Rutgers University at the Board of Trustees meeting, I made exactly that point. when they said, well, we'll still have tennis on campus, intramural tennis, they're totally different. The only point I was making is when you have 20,000 varsity tennis players and close to 400,000 high school varsity players, and you have young people age 12 or 13 or 10 coming to a campus, you, even if no programs were dropped at all, there's a limited percentage that are going to be good enough to get scholarships and play varsity tennis. That's all I was trying to say, is that there's a lot of that, that it's really important, I think, and the ITA believes and the USTA believes, to get a large, large number of young people interested in tennis and to feel that one way or another there will be opportunities in tennis. Now, in terms of scholarships, that's absolutely only varsity tennis. And more than just the scholarships, as I pointed out many times to presidents and athletic directors, comparing tennis on campus and varsity tennis, the coach is a critical factor in the education of a young adult playing sports in college. And tennis on campus is as much fun as it is, and again, it's a great safety valve. There's no coaches. And I think if you talk to most people who play college tennis on the varsity level, part of the experience and part of the benefits is that they have the opportunity to be mentored and to be coached, both in terms of their tennis ability and improving their tennis, but also many other elements in terms of their development, looking ahead to their careers. So, again, that's only in varsity tennis.
Right. And let me point out, and I know you agree with me on this point, that all of the efforts that our governing body is making to grow the game of tennis, if college scholarships are not part of the equation, there is a certain segment of the population that's never going to choose tennis. They're going to find a sport that has the opportunity for that child to get a college education by way of their sport choice. And so it's crucial for the growth of the sport as a whole that we preserve varsity tennis in college as a pathway for these kids. And tennis on campus, again, it's a great recreational alternative, but it is not varsity tennis. We have several callers on the line, David, so I'm going to just bring our first one on. It's area code 864-710. Caller, are you there?
Fine. Hey, David, it's me. It's Chuck Creasy. How are you?
Hey, Chuck, how are you doing?
Just fine. I wanted to first of all say that David has spoken accurately about everything in the history that has happened, and definitely we appreciate his 35 years of work, okay? David, for sure that. But let me just make a couple points, and I'll hang up because you got a lot of callers I know. They, you know, back in 1984 when Title IX started really getting going, and I asked my AD one time, I said, are they going to drop tennis programs? And his comment to me, tennis would be the last thing that would ever cut because you get maximum exposure for the least amount of money. And the facilities are already built, the traditions are there, and we get high-income people and high-profile people to graduate. It's happened just the opposite. Now, Title IX, as it is, I don't want to go there, it's a very great law that has been very poorly implemented, as it was never meant to cut up men's sports. But let me make this point. This is the point that I want to make. The focal point or the tipping point, Lisa, David, and David knows this, was about 1991 when the NCAA cut everything back. The scholarships for men were already cut back, but they cut back playing dates, practicing opportunities. We went from being able to play 50 or 60 matches. By the way, baseball has 66 games right now. They cut us to 35 to 30 to 25. Then what coaches figured out was, whoa, wait a minute, we cannot develop players anymore as easily as we could. So what happened is that the foreign recruiting came in. And what happened with that was that the top 50 U.S. players always got recruited, Lisa, but what happened was that from 50 on down had to compete with 80 other countries in probably their top 10 people. So it's not, and so there's the place where it all changed, and we have not ever gotten that turned around. Right now it's a very, very poor format for development of players. In the 80s we had up to 39 or 40 USA born players that would go to college and go in the top 100 in the world. One time we had 39 players. Today we have two actually right now. Finally we had a second. It's been 20 years on the women's side since Lisa Raymond made it to the top 100 using college as a stepping stone. What I wanted to say was this. It's not about format. It's about foreigners occupying. Nobody's against foreigners. They're against the whole them occupying every scholarship on men's and women's side. Title IX was never set up to protect women from every other country in the world, but it's now the predominant thing in women's tennis as well. So bottom line, it's about that. It's very easy for an athletic director to drop the University of Maryland when they're all international players. Small schools, all international players. We need a 2-scholarship limit. But also, this cutback. How does this cutback again and cutting back the format help anything that we're trying to accomplish in college tennis? I'm going to hang up. David's probably heard me enough over the years, and I just thank you, David, for your work and everything, but it's for not addressing these issues. It's for not getting more playing dates. It's for not we coaches individually standing up and going out and promoting enough in our community. It's not format. I will never believe it's format. The real tennis fans are those that love the kids and those that love the game of tennis. We're barking up the wrong tree otherwise. Thanks for having me on there.
Thanks, Chuck, for calling in. David, do you want to respond? I mean, is ITA looking at working with the NCAA to limit the number of foreign scholarships like the NAIA has done?
Well, first, you know, I appreciate Chuck's words, and we go way, way back to the 70s, and the first when I was elected president, Chuck was elected secretary, and so we've known each other a long time, and Chuck's one of the most knowledgeable people in the world of college tennis and in the tennis world, and there are a lot of important points he raises. And there's been much time that we've discussed, just not Chuck and I, but many of the coaches, a lot of these questions. In terms of the question with international players, at several periods, we actually, in the influx of international players started in the 80s, and it kind of began to snowball as one program was successful with bringing in some international players and winning more matches than another program did the same thing. And we were pretty fragmented as an organization in terms of was this good or bad, and there were a lot of different coaches with different opinions about it. And so we actually, in the 1980s, consulted two pretty high-powered law firms on a pro bono basis just to see what are the options or possibilities from a legal point of view in terms of some sort of rules. A team would only be able to have 2 starters from another country or 3 starters or scholarships. And when the due diligence was done in roughly 1986, 88, both legal opinions that came back was that it would be considered discriminatory and unconstitutional for any national group to try to, as opposed to a school itself, say, you know, any school could say we only want to have 1 international player or no scholarships to international players, but for any national organization to try to pass some rule would be discriminatory, that it would be very quick response on the part of whether a conference or a school to get an injunction and to prevent that rule from being passed. We talked to the NCAA also, and they didn't want in any possible way. They have a number of sports, soccer, track and field, now more and more basketball, that have a fairly high number of international players, and they definitely, and again speaking 15, 20 years ago, didn't want to in any way consider any type of legislation, NCAA legislation. When we started working with the USTA more closely, and again this is about a dozen years ago, the USTA did its due diligence, and it brought in two more law firms to look at the whole question again, and this is again as recent as 8 years ago, and they came up with the same finding that there really isn't any rules that can be passed to change the balance of number of international players getting scholarships on a team, and that the conclusion was on the part of the USTA was that, and I believe it remains its conclusion, that it has to do a much better job in growing a larger and larger pool of outstanding young Americans. Just this last year, the task force looked at the question, and there's roughly 5,000 or 6,000 scholarships available every year at, you know, across all the different divisions, men and women. And in terms of just the number of American juniors who are getting ready to go to college and having rankings in at the junior level, on there were less people with rankings and scholarships available. So there are a lot of things that, you know, could change. But the bottom line is it's up to the athletic director and the president to make the policy for its school. And if the president or the athletic director puts tremendous pressure on the coach to win, and even in the Ivy Leagues, and I, as you mentioned, played at Harvard, coached at Princeton, and I can tell you, even in the Ivy League, coaches have been fired and salaries haven't been increased when they don't do well in the Ivy League. And so there's all this pressure on the coaches to win. College tennis is a huge magnet for the whole world, and there are more and more outstanding young players everywhere. And here's the coach being told, if you don't win, you lose your job, and that's a big problem. So Chuck's absolutely right. This is a dilemma.
Why could NAIA limit the number?
I think the answer is that no one. I don't know if it's NAIA Junior College that has that rule. I thought it was Junior College.
You're right.
Yeah, and I think the reality, at least, is that if you take, let's say, an SEC school that has 4 or 5 international players and has $500,000 budget for tennis, and you have the Sears Cup and Director's Cup, and there's pressure on the athletic directors to win all these titles, and let's say someone did try to pass a rule, and again, the NCAA has told us many, many times at the highest level they will not do this, but some rule were passed, and here's an SEC school saying, wait, you know, you're going to stop us, you're going to tell us that we can't win a title anymore, and we're not going to be able to beat other teams because of this rule you're passing. Well, we feel the rule's discriminatory, and we have just the tennis program, $500,000 budget, so we're going to hire some good lawyers and take you to court right away and get an injunction. Well, at the junior college level, the whole budget all year might be $500. And, you know, I think that's, you know, there isn't the same pressure on the coaches. Often the coaches are, you know, working in other capacities at the school or volunteers. And so it's just a totally different situation. And, you know, we've been told and threatened, I can tell you. I've gotten more, I think hate's a little strong, but very violent letters and accusing me, when we were looking into this, of being hating international people, of being xenophobic. And by the way, my wife is French, and I'm certainly very international in spirit. But people feel, and the coaches, the schools, feel very threatened, and in our country, you know how easy it is for someone to take out a lawsuit or injunction. So, the USTA, just this last year, the current president put together another task force to look at this again, and their conclusion was, as you know, several times before, and I know Patrick McEnroe has said this in public a number of times, you know, one, the international player situation can't be resolved legally or by rules or quotas, and the more and more outstanding young Americans that are playing, the more that the coaches will, because they want to win, be recruiting those players. Now, the other thing, we did a study maybe 8 years ago, but it hasn't changed. In fact, I think more of the top young players are now coming to college. Out of the top 100 juniors in the United States, I think it was something like 94 got scholarships and 2 went to Ivy League schools and 4 didn't come to college. So at the highest level, the highest ranked players, they're certainly getting scholarships. Now, one thing that has changed, and I know my son played college tennis, and I can see everything from the perspective of parents also. 25 years ago, if you were a top, say, 20 player in the country, you probably could pick and choose most of the schools you'd want to go to. Now, some of the schools you might like to go to, there might not be scholarships because they're international players, but there are other schools that are outstanding. But that doesn't make the parent or the student happy if they had their heart set on one school and they can't get into that school. And it really has changed. But if you look at the U.S. Open in the 80s, something like 80% of the field was American. Now it's probably 5%, and that 5% are a number of wild cards. So the whole world has changed in terms of tennis, and that's impacted enormously on college tennis.
All right, let me take another caller. We have a call from area code 812-855. Caller, are you there? 812-855?
Yes, I am. Randy Blumenthal from Indiana University.
Hi,
Randy. Hey, how you doing? I've really enjoyed
good.
Listening to the show, and David, I appreciate all the work and effort over the years, and you know, and the impact you've made on college tennis. I've got a format question, again, kind of a follow up, something that's been a hot topic. It seems like to me, in the you know, going through the history in the mid '80s, we started shrinking the number of matches being played in college tennis, and then early '90s, we started shrinking the format, you know, 8-game pro sets and things like that. And the same time, we started losing popularity with the game, the college game. Not so much in the world. It seems like everything I read is the game is keeps going up in ranking in the world, and college tennis seems to lose ground for some reason. So I felt like at the same time that we're shrinking formats, we're shrinking practice time, you know, and where coaches start supplementing international players and, you know, to make up for the losses one way or another. Can you tell me how this shrinking is helping college tennis? There seems to me to be a direct correlation between the shrinking of the format or whatever it's going to be. There's the shrinking of the game itself and losing popularity with college tennis or losing programs in college tennis. I'll let you talk. Thank you for your time.
Sure. Well, a bunch of things. You know, the what Chuck alluded to and you mentioned, Randy, the reduction of the number of matches you can play was something that we strongly opposed. It was a across-the-board NCAA reduction. The problem is that when they made that original decision to start reducing and limiting the number of matches teams could play, they arbitrarily picked out of a hat, and they meaning NCAA administrators, not college coaches, not the ITA, this was imposed on us, 35 is the magic number, and no one ever was told how they got that number for tennis. As Chuck mentioned, in baseball they had doubled that. And then 5 years later they said, well, and again, the pressure was coming from presidents of universities to have the kids, the student athletes, have more time for studies and not compete as much in all these different sports. So then they cut by another 20%, and so tennis went from 35 to 30, then 30 to 25. The problem is that, you know, and we've managed to get some rules passed as an association. We can't pass a rule. We can put it forward. It has to be sponsored by a number of conferences, and then has to be passed by the Board of Governors of the NCAA. And we don't have the political strength and the power that, say, football or basketball has with a $1 billion budget. And so it's very hard for us, and we haven't been able to say, well, you should give tennis more back some matches, because then the answer of the board of directors of the NCAA is, well, then we'd have to do this in other sports, and we don't want to do that. So it's very frustrating for all of us. In terms of the format, the decision that was made in the late 80s to go doubles first was because of the fact that there were two big problems that over a period of years we the coaches felt were of a major concern. One was that in playing singles where you had to win 5 points, very often there would be one or two matches that would go much longer than the other matches. You wouldn't start doubles until it finished. So you'd have everyone waiting and watching for at least another hour when that last match finished before you could then go play doubles. And so very often the matches, and we're talking back in the 70s and 80s, could be 5-6 hours, and that's if you had six courts. And everyone felt that was a real concern. And the other was that often if the match were won in singles or was about to be won, people either wouldn't play doubles at all. If you won 5 points in singles, you just bagged the doubles, or there are a lot of substitutions would be made, and so you'd get to the end of the spring and you'd see that a number of the better doubles teams were playing very little doubles. And we felt that was a problem because we really felt doubles is a big part of college tennis and it wasn't getting the attention it needed. So it was actually, I think, Paul Scarper who first recommended the format we're now using, and Paul's a brilliant thinker and a tennis mind. And in moving doubles first, we made sure that every match doubles would be played and would be very important. Even though the three doubles matches together were worth 1 point, as everyone knows, that point could be critical deciding the match. So it was very intense and exciting. The compromise of the pro set was, again, to try to find a way so that the overall team match would not be what most people felt was too long at that time, but that it would still be a very significant encounter. And then, of course, it was followed by the singles. So everyone had to play singles and doubles, and really over the years, since we made that change, the women didn't want to do that initially, and they waited 3 more years, but then they decided it worked better also. There haven't been a lot of complaints that I've heard, and I've been at hundreds and hundreds of meetings with many, many coaches, about the doubles first and about the way we're doing it. And of course, Lisa, as you know and as the listeners know, in looking at more experiments and maybe making some more changes, part of the proof that what we did, a lot of people felt worked well, is that a lot of people don't feel we should change it. So, you know, and then in terms of the question of the popularity of tennis, in our country, the peak of popularity was from 74 to 83. And I'm not just talking college tennis, I'm talking tennis. And I remember I was a graduate student at Harvard trying to survive because you don't make any money as a graduate student. So I had a teaching pro job at a big country club in Philadelphia in the summer. And that was the era where you had the Battle of the Sexes, Billie Jean King against Bobby Riggs. And I remember on a Sunday getting back from working all day and turning on the TV, and there was no cable TV. All the three big networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, all had live tennis events all afternoon. So that was kind of the peak, and the Borg-McEnroe rivalry in Connors. And then those that might remember with a long memory, a woman named Sally Jenkins wrote in Sports Illustrated in the 80s a piece said, "Is tennis dying?" So even now, as soon as you get away from the U.S. Open and one or two other events like at Indian Wells or the Sony that just finished, most events are struggling to, professional events to stay even. The tennis industry is not doing particularly well in our country, and the numbers have gone down recently. So I think American college tennis is part of America, and American tennis is struggling, except for something like the Open, which is an extraordinary event and one of the greatest events in the world, but it's a two-week event, and we're talking about 52 weeks. So I think the concern and the dilemma is that in our country, there are so many sports and so many other activities, and tennis is not, and again, I'm not talking college tennis, but just tennis in general is not among the top 5 or 10 sports, whether as a spectator sport or participation. And therefore, what we're seeing on the college scene in terms of the popularity of people coming and watching matches is reflective of what's going on in the country. And in fact, I think we're doing probably better in college tennis than outside of college tennis. And
I think that's a whole show. I'm going to cut you off because I have so many callers on the line, and we're down to our last few minutes.
Sure.
I have a caller from area code 828-266. Caller, are you there? 828-266?
Yeah. Can you hear me, Lisa?
I can.
This is Mike Cernodal from Appalachian State University.
Hey, Mike.
David, it's been a long time. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. Listen, I'd like to go back to the dissolution of the some of the tennis programs from a slightly different perspective and get your take on it. You may not have had a whole lot of time to think about this, but with the potential unionization of the Northwestern football players and the possibility of, them being paid as employees, and also the big issue of athletes being paid, I would suspect one of the concerns from the tennis perspective is that if this occurs with only, I think last year, only 16 athletic programs made money, and 10 of them had to have an infusion from student fees. If athletes start to get paid, where is that money going to come from, and are they going to, with football being the tail that wags the dog, so to speak, what's that going to do to the non-revenue sports such as men's and women's tennis? And I was wondering if you guys, with everything else that's on your plate, and this being fairly recent, had an opportunity to brainstorm about this.
I promise I didn't email Mike and plant that question.
Well, Mike, you're right. It could become a big new issue problem. We really haven't. We had our board meetings and our general membership meetings in December, and although I think one could look back and say that this issue has been looming, it hadn't really hit the headlines yet. And really, there wasn't any discussion at all about this. Obviously, as we look at what happens with the courts and this situation, it could have a big impact on many sports, and it will be something that we'll need to try to address also, because I think you're absolutely right. If more and more pressure is put on schools by this change, and it made the budgets that are already tight that have impacted on our losing tennis programs, if they get even tighter, that could be more and more of a problem. But we really haven't, among the board or among the operating committee or among the membership, it's kind of a new thing. So we really haven't discussed it yet.
Mike, thanks
okay.
so much.
I was just curious. And if you see, if you talk to Penny, please give her my best.
I shall.
Thank you.
We have another caller, area code 864-710. Are you there? Oh, Chuck, that's you again, isn't it?
Oh, that's me. I'm just...
Okay, I'm sorry.
Hey, David, I could just
more talking here, Lisa. let other people on there.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying
Thank
the show.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. Okay, so David, I want to just touch quickly because you mentioned about the importance of doubles to college tennis. And we recently had our last college match day aired on ESPN3 with yet another experimental format where singles were played first and doubles would only be played in the case of a tiebreaker. And guess what? There was not one single doubles match played during these college match days. So where are we headed with all this format change? What do you see coming down the road? Are we going to be able to preserve the nature of our sport and quit messing with scoring and numbers of games played and add, no add, this, that, and the other thing, and just get back to what our beautiful sport was meant to do?
I think it's important whether it's a big company or an association or a university always to look at different possibilities and never to assume that everything's perfect and there shouldn't be any change. That being said, change can be very bad as well as very good. And we were the concept of going back to playing singles first and basically stopping a match if 4 out of 6 players win singles, that was an idea that we first heard about in late August. It was a small group of athletic directors and 1 or 2 other people that put that together. I think, again, they were looking at 2 things, hoping they'd get on actually live cable, not on streaming video, and wanting to make the match fit for that. But also, they started with what I know that the ITA operating committee felt was a very erroneous premise, which was that you had to, no matter what, play 2 out of 3 sets of singles, regular scoring, but keep the match under 3 hours. And so they came up, you know, with the concept, well, we'll go singles first, and if we don't play doubles, big deal. Well, we, the operating committee and the coaches, I think probably 85% of the coaches and 90% of the operating committee feel that doubles is a big deal in college tennis. It's a great part of the development of players' games. It's the only time in a team match where 2 people are playing together against another team. And we felt it was a tremendous mistake to consider any type of change that would essentially do away with doubles. And we had predicted, actually, back in September when we heard about this, that 75% of the matches would not play doubles. As it turns out, looking at what's happened, it's more like 95% have it played 18 doubles. And so we felt very strongly about that then, and we still feel very strongly that the Bryan brothers were quoted saying if that was the format when they were at Stanford for 2 years, they never would have played doubles. And the only thing that has surprised me with the college match day results is that there's only, as far as we know, been 1 time out of 15 or 20 matches, as far as we know, where they played doubles. So, you know, and part of what we're trying to do is look at different possibilities, all of which continue to make doubles a very important part of the match, and see as fairly as we can, with as objective and diverse group of people looking at this, what if there are any changes, what changes would be positive and make sense and keep the integrity of the college team match, and what changes are out of the question, and still reserving judgment should there be any changes. So in terms of trying to create a format for 20 or 30 matches, of which only maybe 10 might be on TV, when we're dealing with thousands of programs and matches, that makes no sense to any of us. But again, we're you know, we did a lot of experimenting this winter. We have a huge amount of data that's been collected. We had over 1,000 matches played with two different ITA experimental formats. The women wanted to try one format and the men a second. We've sent out online surveys to all of the Division I coaches, and we've gotten back a 63% response in 2 weeks, which is a very strong response. And we've also asking the coaches to we've created an online survey for the players. And so we're getting a lot of information back, both just in terms of with the experiments we did, what was the average length of the doubles matches under the experiment, what were the longest, the shortest, what was the average length of singles with different formats. So we'll know a lot more about what this translates to in terms of the experiments, but also a lot of feedback from the coaches and the players. You know, did you feel that if you played Noah that was unfair? Did it change the outcome of the match? Did you think it was more exciting? Did it save some time? Did you, on the women's side, did you feel that playing two sets and then a match tiebreak, was that fair? Do you feel it changed the outcome? Did it favor the weaker team or give an advantage? So, you know, if you talk to any one, college tennis coaches are very bright people, too. They have a lot of opinions. And, you know, we're often in rooms with 30, 50, 100 people at our meetings, and you have a lot of different opinions. And there's no absolute right or wrong, you know. So what we've tried to do over the years is, you know, we operate sort of as a representative democracy. We have an operating committee that has the power to make in Division I, you know, playing rules. We have to work hand in hand also with the NCAA, because if we make a rule that, let's say the rule was that we're going to use regular scoring, and the NCAA tennis committee says that the NCAAs, they're going to use no ed, well, the conferences want to use in their season what the NCAA championships will use. So, you know, we're not, we have to kind of work together, and there are years where we feel one thing might make more sense, but we have to persuade the NCAA tennis committee that that's the way the championships should be played. So we're kind of in the middle now of, well, we've gathered all the data, we're crunching all the information, trying then to understand what does this mean, what will work best, and also some very basic big questions, Lisa. You know, one question is, should men and women have the same format in college tennis? And people, some people feel, well, the women's game in college tennis is somewhat different from the men's game. The points last a lot longer, and maybe a format that works well for the men won't work as well for the women. On the other hand, we have always tried to have as much as we can a common ground in the way we're, you know, when you say here's at the Division I level the team match, you ideally would like to say it's whether it's men or women, it's the same format. So that's a very big question. I don't have an answer to it, but that's one of the questions we have to look at.
But you know, an adjunct to that then is, if college tennis is to continue, or hopefully, I guess it's, you, continue is the wrong word now, but if college tennis is to be a stepping stone to the professional tour, the players need to train and play the same way in college that they would then play on the tour. And by messing with the format every year, I mean, it just seems that it relegates college tennis to, you know, not being a stepping stone to the tour, that top young players, when they see these format changes, just as Bob and Mike Bryan said, you know, they never would have played up the current format and probably would have taken a different pathway to the career that they've made. So we're down to our last few seconds. I really just want to say thank you to you for being with us today, for being so frank and honest in the discussion, and I want to thank all the callers and those of you that I didn't get to. I apologize, but this is an important discussion, and I hope we can continue it, David. I hope you can come back on maybe after the NCAA championship this year, and we can kind of rehash what went on through the whole season and talk about where we're headed for next year.
Well, thanks, Lisa, and again, I appreciate your inviting me and having a chance to talk with you and the callers. And as we know, we could talk for hours about this, and we have been talking for hundreds of hours, and I'd be glad to come back and talk more later, as you said, maybe after the NCAA, and see what direction we're heading. But I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk, and appreciate all that you're doing to help college tennis.
Well, thank you. To my listeners, thanks for being with us this week. Hope you all have a great week, and the link to the podcast will be at parentingaces.com/radioshow later today. So please share it with your friends. Thank you again, David, and to the rest of you, I will talk to you next Monday. Have a great week, everybody.